Hello, and welcome to I Am The Egg Pods with me, Chris Shaw. The Egg Pods take a jaunty stroll through Pepperland, discussing the Beatles and solo Beatle albums with a potpourri of delicious guests. In this bonus episode, I'm joined by journalist, speaker, and author of acclaimed books on human behaviour, Ian Leslie.
Hello, Chris.
Hello.
Very nice to be here.
How are you?
I'm good, thank you. I'm just delighted to be on this show, one of my favourite podcasts.
Oh, thank you. Your book, Conflicted, I guess everybody who speaks to you uses the phrase, it's much needed at the moment. But I think in Beatles community, there's a strong argument about who sang the R's on A Day in the Life. Tell me briefly about, because you examine why arguments tear us apart and how they can actually bring us together.
Yeah, so the book is about how to have better disagreements. Because, I mean, so very briefly, you know, I think we look around at all the kind of terrible, toxic arguments that we see around us, and also some of the stressful arguments that we get into, and we think, oh, this is terrible. Yeah. I've got to avoid it. But actually, once you do that, you're cutting off an immense source of creativity and insight and connection to people, actually. You get closer to people, I think, in argument. And so the book is about how to, you know, just do it better. You know, how to argue better in a way that actually leads to insight and ideas rather than acrimony. And actually, like just about everything I do, it does touch on the Beatles. There's one or two stories about the Beatles in there, so I'll leave that to listeners to discover for themselves.
Superb. And as most Beatles people will know, you recently went viral with your essay 64 Reasons to Celebrate Paul McCartney, which I have to say is a pure joy to read. What drove you to put pen to paper for that?
Oh, yeah, I mean, look, I'm basically, as anyone who's read that piece will know, I'm a huge Beatles fan, but and particular a McCartney fan, and just for a long time I've been thinking about writing a big piece about him, because I kind of think he's underrated, which sounds absurd, but I think we sort of take him for granted a little bit. And you know, you'll say you're a huge Paul McCartney fan, and someone say, oh, frog chorus. Or, you know, oh yeah, he's a bit cheesy. Yeah. He does that thumbs up all the time. And, you know, just, it's infuriating and just sort of ignorant, basically.
Yeah.
And I think anyone who kind of thinks a lot about the Beatles or, you know, is a big fan is just in awe of his contribution to that awe inspiring group. And then actually his post Beatles career is also huge. So I just think, you know, we have this giant, really, you know, somebody who's on the level of our great poets and artists, somebody who will be remembered in hundreds of years, you know, more so than you know, very few people on that level. And yet we treat him like he's just this kind of, you know, funny celebrity who happens to be still around. I just think it's ridiculous. So I wanted to write this piece and say, look, this guy isn't insane genius, absolutely on the level of you know, Bach, Beethoven, Picasso, whoever. So I ended up writing this piece partly because it was lockdown, and it was always going to be quite a personal piece because it was really sort of getting things off my chest. So I didn't pitch it to a magazine or anything like that. I was just like, I'm going to write it, I'm going to self-publish it, and I published it, and it went absolutely mad. People loved it, and people responded
It was a brilliant read.
People responded very emotionally to it. You know, I think a lot of people have that sense of gratitude and awe and love for him. And I, you know, happened to be able to articulate some of that, and people, you know, responded very strongly to it.
Absolutely, yeah. If you haven't found it, just Google Ian Leslie 64 Reasons to Celebrate Paul McCartney. It's a wonderful read.
Thank you.
So, Ian, I have to ask, when did you first discover the Beatles?
Right, so I have a terrible autobiographical memory. I sort of go through life, you know, not really knowing where I've come from. But I do remember sitting in my parents' front room and picking up Beatles records from the gramophone. Inside the, you know, there's a gramophone that you can't, and you lift the lid, and inside you can, there's a place to keep LPs, yeah. And as well as the turntable, and one of the LPs was a greatest hits collection that actually came out kind of 1966, I think, or something like that, called A Collection of Beatles Oldies But Goldies.
Oh, you've got it there.
Yeah.
You still have it.
And I was at my mum's house at the weekend, and I said, can I take this? Because I'm going to be on this podcast. as a kind of amulet. So, and on the back is a photo. By the way, the fact that they were kind of having a collection of oldies but goldies in 1966. I love the fact that Beatles history is like so compressed, so that there was already a kind of sense of Beatles nostalgia. Yeah. You know, two or three years after they had broken through, you know, suddenly like, oh, let's look back on all those years ago, you know, to 1963, whatever it was. Anyway, so it's a collection of hits from between 63 and 65 or something like that. She Loves You, Michelle, Help, Eleanor Rigby's on there. So maybe, yeah. So, it's an absolutely fantastic, it's got a great cover, and on our back cover, it's got an amazing photo of them sitting in, I think, in Japan.
Yeah.
And they look impossibly glamorous. And certainly they did to me then, and they still do now. And Paul in particular kind of, I don't know why I sort of latched on to him, but he became my favourite Beatle. Perhaps because he was still a pop star. So I was growing up in this is in the 80s. And I've really followed his solo career. So I was getting into the Beatles, and I was also into him. Now, my friends were not into Paul McCartney. My friends were, you know, normal kids. and they were, you know, I grew up in a school in sort of in Lewisham, Southeast London, a comprehensive school. My friends were into electro and funk, and I was playing them. You know, I'd go around to their house and say, have you listened to Tug of War by Paul McCartney? And they'd say, well, they were nice boys. So they would say, yeah, sure, yeah, we'll listen to that. Actually, you know, they kind of liked it, but it was not kind of like mainstream. And then from, I started getting their Beatles records out, because my parents weren't huge Beatles fans. They just had this LP. But I went to the local library a lot and I got Beatles albums out from there, and then Wings albums, and that really kind of, that was it really. I think I read Shout by Philip Norman, and once you're kind of swept up in the story of the band as well as the music, then that's it. You know, you're just lost. There's no way out, and you're just in Beatles world, and it's a sort of an inexhaustible source of amazement and inspiration and joy.
I totally agree. I think that is the key point. When you get your first Beatles book, suddenly you've got not only all the music, you've got an amazing story.
Yeah, and to complement it. It's a story that just seems to go on and on. You know, it's not like it's not like the mystery of it diminishes the more you know. In fact, quite the opposite. Do you see what I mean? You kind of think, well, maybe if I read too much about them, and I read too much about how Sgt. Pepper was made or whatever, it'll just sort of destroy the sheer spontaneous enjoyment. But it's sort of the other way around. The more you find out about it, the more you think, what the hell was going on there? You know, it's truly, truly mysterious. I love this thing that the great producer and musician Rick Rubin said about the Beatles. He said, The Beatles between 1964 and 1966 is the best argument for God that I know of. You know, because it's just so, you know, utterly kind of beyond. It's not something you can kind of make sense of rationally. Like that, you know, the speed with which they moved, the number of things that they did, the difference they made in such a sort of short period of time is absolutely baffling. So, yeah, it just never gets old to me. And to you, to many of us.
Absolutely. So, based on your article, today we're going to discuss 12 reasons to celebrate Paul McCartney, and you've picked a selection of songs. Tell me the process to break it down into just 12. Must have been a nightmare.
Well, it was a complete nightmare. So we came up with this idea, you know, you and I, of let's talk about Paul McCartney, and let's kind of pick... I started off as 10 songs, and then I realised I couldn't do that. And I set myself an impossible task here. It became more possible once I realised it was impossible, and there was no point trying to pick 10 songs, which, you know, you can't do Paul McCartney's 10 best songs. I mean, maybe somebody can, you know, but I'm not going to try that. It's just sort of, I would change my mind just every day about that. And you can't even do, you know, the 10 most important or typical Paul McCartney songs. I think all you can do and all, so what I've done is just pick 10 songs that each kind of represent something I think is important about him. Important to understand about him as an artist. And in fact, not all of them are by him, right? So there's one or two here which are either covers or there's a cover, there's a John Lennon song. But they all kind of hopefully weave together into a kind of picture of who he is as a person, as an artist.
There were bells on a hill, but I never heard them ringing. No, I never heard them at all till there was you. There were birds in the sky, but I never saw them winging. No, I never saw them at all till there was you.
So we start with a song from With the Beatles in 1963. It was written by Meredith Wilson for the 1957 musical The Music Man, but Paul would have heard it through Peggy Lee's 1958 version. It's Till There Was You.
Yeah, it's sort of odd to start Paul McCartney in 12 songs. Let's start with a song that's not by Paul McCartney. But to me, this song is so interesting because it was not a kind of a given that Till There Was You was the kind of song that the Beatles would do, right? I think if Paul McCartney wasn't in the band and it was, you know, Lennon and Harrison, they would have been more of a kind of rock and roll band, right? And it was McCartney who was really pushing them. He later talked about it as, you know, looking to the left and right of rock and roll, pushing them to explore all kinds of other songs, including pop songs and musical. And they were open to it, right? So I'm not saying it was just him, but he was the kind of driving force there. And it's easy to think that basically what happens is Elvis comes along and the Beatles, you know, the young Beatles and of course a whole generation get turned onto rock and roll, forget everything that they've ever heard. And that's it. And that's not right. You know, particularly with the Beatles and particularly with McCartney, the music they grew up on, which was pop, was, you know, crooners, songs from films, songs from musicals, songs from the radio, songs, you know, in his case, that his dad would sing or his family would sing around the piano. So folk songs and just sing alongs and all. That remained hugely part of his musical heritage, right? That was in his blood. And he didn't sort of disavow that. He didn't say, "Oh, right, now I'm into rock and roll. All that stuff can go to hell." He just saw rock and roll as this tremendously exciting catalyst. But then he took everything else along with him and all that kind of, you know, from trad jazz to music hall to pop. Infuses then everything that he does and that they do. And so Till There Was You, you know, it's not a kind of cool rock and roll blues song. It's a kind of a, you know, sweet, poppy love song. And he used to sing it kind of gazing over the heads of the audience at the cavern or in Hamburg with this kind of doe-eyed look on his face, which frankly, he still adopts. And he knew that he looked cute, right? But also, and I said this in the piece, I think it's interesting because in a way, that pose that he has of looking over the audience so that he can't see them looking at him. So it's almost protective, right? It's almost a kind of way of, you know, not, so you can't see me. You can see this face that I'm putting on. And that is also kind of key to understanding him as an artist and a musician. So Lennon is much more, you know, he rips open his chest and he says, "Here's my heart." He rips out his heart and kind of holds it up. "Here it is. Here I am." And McCartney is not going to show you who he is so easily. There's kind of layers and layers going on. So most of all, I think this song is just evocative of the fact that he was saying, there's no reason to restrict ourselves to any one genre. All music is ours, right? We have this immense inheritance, this cultural kind of playground. Let's go play in it. Let's go to every part we can. Just this sense of freedom, really, that I think he and they really brought to everything that they did.
Yeah. Paul said Paul said, I had an older cousin, and she was quite an influence on me. Betty would play me records like Peggy Lee's Fever. Peggy Lee did Till There Was You as well. I didn't know that was from the musical The Music Man until years later. This led me to do songs like A Taste of Honey and things which were slightly to the left and the right of rock and roll. But interestingly, before I started doing this, I contacted Kate Robbins about her mum, Betty, who he's talking about. And she said that Betty introduced lots of music to Paul, including classical composers like Debussy. So interestingly, you can hear that influence in the first movement of Paul's 2011 classical piece, Ocean's Kingdom.
Right.
So it's weird, aside from the musical influence of his dad, so you, like you say, all the jazz standards and show tunes, Betty Robbins is very much underplayed in the story because she effectively took on a maternal role for both Paul and Mike. And
that's absolutely
really
fascinating.
Expanded their horizons, I think.
Yeah. Now, usually when we talk about Paul kind of imbibing some sort of high culture, we think about Jay Nash's family, but he was already doing it, right? So that's really interesting. Mm-hmm. And one of the kind of striking things about him is that he was so culturally omnivorous. He was just soaking up everything from anywhere all the time. Mm-hmm. So even at school, you know, he was obstinately, you know, unwilling to be a good student at school. But even there, he picked up an immense amount, you know, especially literature. You know, he's kind of often refers back to some of the poems and stories that he read there. And throughout his life, right up until the present day, he constantly struck by what a hungry and determined and fast learner he is. Right? He's picking up information from everywhere. It just not sort of never stops. And again, there's no sort of sense of hierarchy or kind of, oh, I can't go there, or that's not for me, or that's for other people. Right. It's like, no, I'll have that. Yep, interested in that. Yep, take that on board. You know, he did an interview the other day with the New York Times the other month. He said, I'm reading Proust. Again, why not? Yeah, it's like, so that kind of incredible sense of gratitude for everything that the world has to offer and a determination to make the most of it is very, very him.
I've just seen a face, I can't forget the time or place where we just met. She's just a girl for me and I want all the world to see we've met. Had it been another day, I might have looked the other way and I'd have never been aware. But as it is, I'll dream of her tonight.
So next we move on to another acoustic number, this time from the Help album, and briefly called Auntie Jin's theme, because his aunt loved it. It's I've Just Seen a Face.
So, first of all, I just love this song, and perhaps a slightly underrated song in his repertoire. I love the way it kind of it rollicks along.
it does.
The way that the lines trip over themselves. Right, so there's a kind of breathless quality to it, which really captures this sense of falling. Falling. Yes, I'm falling, and somebody just being just swept away by things, and but in the music as well as you can hear it in the music as well as in the words, and of course it's just another kind of genre. I don't know. It's like kind of country-ish. You can imagine Dolly Parton or somebody singing this. It's played with tremendous energy and verve. So I love the song, but it's also, I wanted to pick it because it was recorded, and you'll know the details of this better than me, but on a day when they recorded two other songs of his in wildly different styles.
Well, yeah, it was three songs they did, and the order that they did them in as well I find even more interesting. So they started with I've Just Seen a Face, then moved on to I'm Down, and then ended with Yesterday.
Yeah, so I'm Down, in case, I'm sure everyone does know it, but you know, I'm Down is this Little Richard style howler, right? He absolutely rips it to pieces, you know, shreds his vocal cords, and really kind of tears into it, and it's absolutely brilliant, right? Well, and that would be enough for one day. Surely you'd need a week to recover from that. But But then he goes back and they record this lovely kind of free-flowing, country-ish kind of number. And then, yeah, so then they go back and record Yesterday, a beautiful, beautifully sung ballad. And I wrote about this in the piece, you know, another thing we take for granted is that McCartney and Lennon were not just great songwriters, but they had all these other things. You know, they were also two of the greatest rock vocalists. You know, if they hadn't written any songs, we'd be saying these guys are incredible singers.
Yeah.
Again, going back to kind of Rick Rubin's kind of question about God, you know, makes you kind of reconsider, like, what the hell was going on here? Why were these guys given so many different, you know, these immense kind of different gifts? Mm. And McCartney's gift is really about his incredible versatility and his ability to kind of inhabit different modes of singing and different characters. And here you see him just do three really wildly different songs in one day and do them better than most people could do any of them. And just sort of knock them off in a few takes each. And then by about 10 o'clock that evening, he was in a bar with Jane Asher. The incredible, frustratingly, wildly kind of like effortlessness of it, or seeming effortlessness of it is just sort of blows my mind.
Yeah, we've talked about it a lot on here, but about Paul's different voices. But to be that extreme in one afternoon, early evening, blows my socks off.
It's almost inhuman. there was, actually, this brings to mind something, probably you can cut this if it's completely irrelevant, but the great film critic David Thompson wrote a piece about Steven Spielberg's genius, and he said the thing that always struck me about Spielberg is that he was making Jurassic Park and Schindler's List at the same time. You know, we saw finishing Jurassic Park as he was making Schindler's List, or the other way around. There's something sort of inhuman about a genius that could do that. and something about McCartney where you just go, wow, okay, he could just do all these different things and do them all with utter conviction and accomplishment. And yet sort of didn't seem like a big deal to him. It was just like, yeah, and I'm going to do this and I'm going to do this. Nobody else could have had that day in the studio.
And then end it by, well, right, Jane, we're going to go to the Cromwellian Cocktail Bar and Discotheque. it's real. You mentioned her before, but I mean, this song was actually composed at Jane Asher's parents in Wimpole Street. So I think as well as highlighting the circles Paul was starting to move in, that also says a lot about the liberal attitude of Mr. and Mrs. Asher, because, you know, he was living there with their daughter.
Yeah, indeed. And they play such an important role in the development of the Beatles via him because of their hospitality and their generosity and what must have been, you know, I don't know anything about them except what I've read about him, but what must have been this attitude to life, which was similar to his, which was, hey, look at this. Isn't this great? And there's no sense of, oh, you won't get this because, you know, you're this kid from Liverpool. Or you're this scruffy rock and roller. Why on earth should we? No, none of that. All of them, you know, the different ages. And someone was like, hey, Paul, have you heard, you know, what an oboe can sound like? Or have you listened to Bach, Brandenburg Concerto? Check out this artist, you know, whatever it is. Again, they just sort of shared, I think, his openness to life and to people.
Penny Lane, there is a barber showing photographs of every head he's had the pleasure to know, and all the people that come and go stop and say hello. On the corner is a banker with a motor car, the little children laughing at him.
Next, recorded throughout December 66 and January 67 and released on the 17th of February 1967 as a double A-side with Strawberry Fields Forever, you've picked Penny Lane.
So he creates this half familiar, half odd, you know, half surreal scene with all sorts of things that seem normal at first glance, but then you look at them a bit closer and they're quite odd and quirky. Like the banker who refuses to wear a Mac in the pouring rain.
the fireman with his hourglass. I mean, what's a fireman got an hourglass for? It's one of those references, though, that to time and to time passing that were embedded throughout the song. And he conveys this sense of longing and nostalgia for something lost, right? So it's a sort of, it's joyful and it's sad at the same time. There's a sense of an idyll from childhood and maybe from history that maybe never existed, right? So he introduces this nurse towards the end of the song, smartly dressed, pretty nurse, selling poppies from a tray. And poppies, of course, being a remembrance of the past, of things past, and of people passing. And Paul's mum was a nurse, of course. And it gives her this extraordinary line, this brilliant thought. And though she feels as if she's in a play, she is anyway. And I just think that's absolute genius. It's a brilliant line. The song kind of pivots around that line. He's creating this sense of a world that's real and not real at the same time, and just sort of suggesting that maybe what we see around us is a kind of collective dream or hallucination, and that it's life as we know it, and at the same time it's very strange.
Yeah, because Paul said when he was writing it, we were writing childhood memories, recently faded memories from 8 or 10 years before. So it was a recent nostalgia, pleasant memories for both of us. All the places were still there. And because we remembered it so clearly, we could have gone on. But what you were saying about the Beatles oldies but goldies, you know, they're releasing a nostalgic album from songs barely 3 years old. So just 8 years ago would have been a lifetime away from them.
So it is genuinely
nostalgic.
Yeah, and they write about death a lot. They write about childhood a lot. They write about death a lot, you know, whether it's Eleanor Rigby, Babies in Black. The sense of that death and life are intertwined, you know, that you can incorporate them into your music. I don't know, this is just like, there's a lot going on here. And it's reflected in the production, right? So he uses four pianos at once or something. He uses different pianos all playing the same notes, so that you get this layering effect, and that's kind of reflected in both the words and the music. It's just like layer after layer after layer that aren't immediately obvious at first.
I guess I don't know how long we would have talked. I could talk about this for 4 hours, but
we can keep talking about it, because we haven't even talked about, you know, the trumpet solo. Yeah. And again, you know, talking about his ability to kind of draw from high culture and low culture. He watches, you know, Bart Brandenburg performance on TV, and he's like, yeah, I'll have that. Get me a trumpeter. Here's how to play it. You can't play it that high? Oh, yes, you can. Come on. Yes. Especially this guy's like, okay.
Yeah. And I think Pet Sounds we have to mention.
Right. Yeah.
The Beach Boys, the previous year, had been voted the number one band in the world and finally knocked the Beatles off briefly. But
well, he wasn't going to have that, was he?
Well, no. So I mean, there's going to be that.
Yeah. That's another side of things like that. Exactly. Incredibly, incredibly competitive. Yeah. And so, yeah, so that's kind of reflected in the production, the use of wind instruments, right? And you can hear him kind of going, you know what? I'll take some of that. I can do that.
And it can be broken down to so many levels. But another thing I love is the sort of stealth chords where he gets from the end of a chorus back into the verse. All it takes is, meanwhile, back. There is so much going on to get it back into the right key.
Right, yeah.
Sounds
yeah,
so easy, yeah. But it's so difficult to do.
Right. And that is the key to understanding him and his music over and over. You know, these things that sound effortless and smooth, they just sort of make you feel good. You look at it and you go, how the hell did he do that? You know, that's really hard. But he just kind of was throwing it off at this stage. But he's also, you know, we're talking about the production, you know, he's obsessive. He's an absolute maniac, you know, to say, okay, I want four different pianos that they're all going to be playing the same thing, but the different sounds. And it did remind me of a quote I saw once. I was going to use it in the piece, but I didn't in the end because it's a bit mad, but I kind of like it. From a psychoanalyst, a kind of Freudian psychoanalyst who wrote a book once about the Beatles or about McCartney, I can't remember, but he said of McCartney specifically, he said he is an obsessive, by which, and he had a particular definition of an obsessive, which is somebody who is obsessed with whether or not he is alive or dead. Now, I don't totally understand what that means, but I kind of like that.
Yeah,
there is something about that. There is something about, you know, obviously he grew up with death, very present part of his life, and he's got this incredible hunger for life, you know, determination to be alive as intensely as possible.
Next, from the White Album, 1968, and written during their retreat to Rishikesh, it was later recorded on the 22nd and 23rd of August. It features Paul on vocals, backing vocals, piano, electric guitar, bass guitar, drums, hand claps and percussion, back in the USSR.
I mean, look, first of all, this is my wife's favourite Beatles song, so I had to choose it. I mean, she's a Beatles fan, not a Beatles like nerd like us, but she loves Beatles, but and she really brought to my attention what a fantastic song this is. You know, it doesn't always kind of make the top tens of great Beatles songs, but it's absolutely, again, there's this kind of thrillingly kind of effortless feeling about it. It's a great pop song, but it really rocks as well. It's an incredible kind of drive to it. It's amusing to me that he's playing the drums on it. That, again, it's like, okay, so is this because Ringo walked out and he's like, oh, it's okay,
yeah,
I'll just play the drums.
It was because of this song, because Paul didn't like something.
Right, so he's like, okay.
He didn't
okay,
like it.
I'll do it.
Yeah, you know, that's it. They kept going. It's not, oh, come on, Ringo, come on. Oh, okay, then.
No, I mean, you know, the one thing about Paul McCartney is that he will keep going, because it doesn't matter how many of you walk out.
Yeah.
He can do it. He can play all those instruments. So he's going to fill in, and he's going to do it pretty well. And he's going to play the bass along with the drums so that they sound like an incredible band rather than the same person doing both. The whole thing is just, again, it's just kind of like, I'm going to write this brilliant, witty. Is this a lot of this for me? The joy of it is the words. And we haven't even got to the fact that onto his, particularly about his lyrics, but he could do so many things with words, and because he's written so many songs that, which don't have great lyrics, he's now become, you know, maybe a little bit underrated as at his best. And he's written some of the greatest lyrics ever, right? I'm not saying this song is on that level, but look at it. It's brilliant. Show me around your snow peak mountains way down south. Take me to your daddy's farm. Let me hear your balalaikas ringing out. Come and keep your comrade warm. I mean, it's so funny. And it's so fun. It's so well observed. And then he kind of throws in this pastiche of the Beach Boys in the middle. Almost contemptuously. Almost as they say. Oh, yeah, that thing you do. I love it. I'm going to do it. And I'm just going to throw it in as a middle eight. And
I must say, while we're on the topic, because Mike Love was obviously in Rishikesh with them. According to Mike, this is his quote, "I was sitting at the breakfast table and McCartney came down with his acoustic guitar and he was playing Back in the USSR. And I told him that what you ought to do is talk about the girls all around Russia, the Ukraine and Georgia. He was plenty creative not to need any lyrical help from me, but I gave him the idea for that little section." I don't know about that. Because it is almost contemptuous.
Well, exactly. It's like, sure, I could do that. Look at this. I just find the whole thing, the whole song, just completely irresistible. Once you get swept along with the fun of it, because the White Album is so sort of amazingly dark and complex and sprawling, we sometimes overlook the fact that it's also still, it's got some of those great pop bangers in there as well, and that's what this is. I just think it's a joy,
and it's Lennon level wit, you know. Everybody's It's a cliche, isn't it? Lennon was the witty bit. But I think, like, the Georgian Mountains one is, George is always on my mind.
I mean, brilliant. Yeah. And every verse has got some, you know, great joke in it like that. And, you know, like they say in acting, that comic actors are sort of underrated because actually comic acting is incredibly hard to do. And I think writing funny lyrics, witty lyrics in a rock and roll song, also very, 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 very hard to do, and perhaps harder than writing a sort of deep sounding song. But McCartney's like, why not? I can do that.
Next, we have a very strange choice. It's the B-side of Get Back. You've picked Don't Let Me Down.
Yeah, so this is obviously not a Paul song. It's a John song, and it's a very John song, if you see what I mean. It's really him at his most personal and heartfelt. And doing what he could do, the thing that he could do that perhaps Paul couldn't do or didn't do as much, which was just as I say, just take out his heart and, you know, show it to you, and just be this incredible kind of powerfully direct approach. The chorus is so simple, you know, what is it, like three notes that are the same, and then a fourth one,
yeah,
Don't Let Me Down, and the words are so simple, but it just sort of really kind of grabs you. But the reason I wanted to talk about it here was that Paul's contribution to the song, I think, is so important. And I find that very, very touching. So his vocals, his backing vocals, you can hear in the rooftop concert, you can see, you know, how committed he is to them. And they really kind of give the song like an incredible, you know, they add a lot of oomph, of power to it. And his bass, his bass playing here is just lovely, particularly in the section where he goes kind of, don't you know it's gonna last? There's this kind of lovely kind of lilting, downward facing bass figure that he does, very, very typically melodic. And, you know, this is a song about the woman who was, in a sense, replacing Paul in John's affections. You know, somebody who in some ways John had almost consciously said, you know, I'm with her now. This isn't the same, you and I, as it was. And although I do think I'm not a kind of, you know, Yoko split up the Beatles, it's obviously not much more complex and interesting than that. And they were still, John and Paul were still getting on, as we can see in some of that footage. I mean, clearly there was like an emotional tension and a kind of rupture going on here, and this song is a kind of direct soul bearing love song to her. And I think the fact that Paul really throws himself into it is, I find that very beautiful, a very beautiful expression of his greater love for John, which kind of went beyond, he's my mate. Why is he going around with this woman now? Why is he spending so much time with her? He wanted him to be happy, and he wanted to kind of share in it. And you can hear that in his voice, in his singing, and his total commitment to the song. I just think that's kind of lovely. It's also just an example of him. And not the kind of biggest example, there are others, of him raising one of the other songs by 10, 20, 30%, which is just happens again and again. And I think they all do it to each other's songs, right? They all add contributions which make the other songs better. But I think he did it more than any of them, whether it's his bass playing, like on Come Together, John's song, you know, or Taxman, George's song, or his backing vocals, just over and over everywhere. But, you know, Nowhere Man, bass playing and his backing vocals, actually. Or his, you know, Tomorrow Never Knows, his sort of studio innovation. That Mellotron on Strawberry Fields Forever, right? It's just Strawberry Fields Forever is kind of the archetypal, the greatest John song, perhaps, or, you know, certainly up there. Mm. And yet it's got McCartney all over it. And particularly that beautiful childlike and creepy at the same time organ figure that really kind of makes the mood of the song right from the off. That was Paul. So there's a kind of generosity, I think, is the word here, both in terms of the emotional generosity to be part of John's new love, but also his artistic and musical generosity. He was just all over the Beatles' work.
Yeah, as you say, it's such a personal song for John to sing. And I think it's one thing opening his heart to the world, because it's just throwing it out there. But it's sometimes more of a challenge to do that in front of your mates. And I think Paul especially. I wonder if things like Julia from the White Album, because Paul was there during the recording session, he was encouraging John. And both of them knew what that song was about. They both knew what it meant and how personal it was. And I think it's John got the confidence right. Well, I've sang that in front of my mate. Now I'm going to sing about my love, you know, open myself up that much. And I find it's Paul, his contribution to this song is, yeah, I wish you well. It's him kind of throwing confetti over them.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's beautiful.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. In the end, it's not so much, can I say this in front of my mates? It becomes, I can say this because my mates are with me, you know, because I've got Ringo, George.
Yeah.
Paul, you know, they just give me that sense of security and stability that enables me to show my utter vulnerability in front of this woman and the world. Julia, I mean, yeah, I could have included Julia here because, as you say, I you know, for a long time, the story about the White Album was they all go and do their separate thing in different parts of Abbey Road, and they're basically soloists who happen to come, which is just nonsense. And Julia is great example of that. I mean, it is just John and his acoustic guitar. But then, yeah, you can now hear on the kind of outtakes that Paul was up there in the control room and he didn't say much, but he's just there.
Yes. Yeah.
Which is what you want a friend. You know, when John's singing about this incredibly personal thing, and Paul knew Julia, John's mum. And, of course, he knew Yoko, and the song's about both of them. He shared, you know, Paul had also, of course, lost his mum. So he knew whereof John was speaking. And the fact that he was there, basically adding encouragement now and again, just saying, you know what, it sounds good, John. Don't worry about it. Because John was very nervous. Again, I find that a very moving story.
Every night I just want to go out, get out of my head. Day I don't want to get up, get out of my bed. Every night I want to lay out, and every day I want to do. But tonight I just want to stay in and be with you, and be with you.
Next, from the McCartney album, Every Night.
So again, on one level, this is just a great pop song, really great pop song. Again, it has, like we've been talking about, that almost thrown off, effortless quality that's actually incredibly hard to achieve. But it's also about, it's about depression. It's about not wanting to get out of bed. It's about going out at night and getting out of my head. Like, just somebody who is just so stuck in his own head and in his own thoughts that he doesn't know what to do with himself. And then he finds a way out through the love of a good woman. Of course it was written around the time when he was going through really pretty severe depression. If you look at interviews with McCartney in kind of 1968, he really is quite a cocky bastard. You know, he's quite, even for somebody who's like me, who's like a big fan of his and who basically likes him, some of these interviews you go, oh my God, you're so smug. And when he talks about what happened around the time of the Beatles breakup, he acknowledges that and he says, you know, basically this was what I was pretty cocky and this really was the end of that. And he really couldn't get out of bed around this time. He was drinking a lot. Linda was just incredibly, you know, they hadn't been going out that long.
No.
She just kind of didn't know what to do and was just sort of terrified of what was going to happen and where this was going to go. And he was just, out of all of them, you wouldn't have predicted that he would be the one most emotionally shattered by the breakup of the band, right? Because he was always the one who was most kind of driven and together and he could obviously write and play instruments, so he was going to be okay. But he was the one who took it hardest, sort of left him feeling completely useless, on the scrap heap, purposeless, no direction. Mm. And you can hear that just in the opening chord of the song. It opens on that kind of suspended. A suspended chord is one that really intensely needs to resolve onto something. It transmits anxiety. And of course, when you're depressed, you are kind of suspended. You're in this place where you just think, I don't know what my direction is. You know, I don't know where I'm going. I just can't get out of this sort of bad equilibrium that I've got stuck in. And I'm just sort of suspended in that. But you can just hear it, right? You can hear the pain and the anxiety in that chord, which then over the course of the song gradually gets washed away. And the song kind of builds until by the end of it, it just feels completely kind of positive and it's kind of just moving along, right? It's got direction. It's just sort of like a train that's now kind of moving out of the station. And that line where he says, but tonight I just want to stay in and be with you. I mean, I think it's just sort of the moment when he realizes that actually I can just be, my purpose in life is to be in love and to have a family and to be creative. I actually don't need to be in a band and I don't need to do this. I can actually find, I can satisfy my sort of hunger and for exploration and for creativity within the context of family life, which was very, as I say in the piece that I wrote, very kind of countercultural, because around this time, you know, that wasn't the kind of thing a rock star did. You know, rock stars were meant to be completely, you know, shattering this bourgeois kind of family unit, and certainly that was John's point of view. He was hanging out with straights. Never really kind of got the group. He didn't really kind of get Linda. You know, he didn't understand why Paul was going out with this, you know, Tweedy, as I think he called her. And Paul's kind of rejection of that kind of rip it up and, you know, anti-domesticity, anti-kind of conventional family, anti-ordinariness. Paul just didn't like that, and so he says, you know, I'm straight, fine, call me straight, I've got straight babies, whatever. He was really kind of creating a new way to be a man, a creative artistic man, because if you were I think, you know, there were two ways to be. You could either be a straight, somebody who kind of just had a job and raised a family and was just ordinary, or you could be a kind of romantic towering genius who didn't live by the normal rules. And McCartney was like, well, no, I just don't buy that. And he got a hard time for it. He got a hard time from Lennon, got a hard time for it from the rock press. And in a sense, his reputation has never recovered from striking out along that path.
I had a conversation ages ago with Ian Lee, who mentioned he had a friend from America, and the conversation basically, Ian was saying something like, yeah, Wings, they've always been almost mocked in the UK. You know, you got your Partridge quotes and that sort of thing. And the guy from the US had no idea what he was talking about. He just, what? Why? And I think it seems like, you think Uncle Albert, Admiral Halsey was released in the US and it was a number one single. And that didn't happen over here. if he'd started with that, Wings would have been deemed, I think, a much different band, initially at least, because that would have been continuing on from the Beatles. But it seems to be a UK thing more so than the US.
Yeah.
Perception of Wings as this something to mock, almost. I don't think it is now, but for years, as you say, yeah, rock critic. You read reviews from 70 till about 85, and they ain't great.
Oh, absolutely. And this is before Wings, isn't it? This is McCartney. But he got off to a bad start, you know, in the critic's eyes with this, because it was so deliberately kind of lo-fi, as we'd call it now. I mean, you know, another genre that he started. Unpolished, kind of thrown off. And which, again, was sort of defiant, I think, both to what was expected of him and maybe to John as well, saying, yeah, you'd have probably never let me record this. But I don't care. I can do what I want now. Anyway, he does that. And then he starts a band with his wife. And again, he's sort of reveling in domesticity and not doing what the world expects or wants a genius to do. The world, particularly at least the critics, don't forgive him for that. But as it turns out, he's immensely popular still, and Wings sell a ton of records. You know, and so he really kind of has, more than any of the others do, just a second hugely successful career with a different band.
Next, from the Band on the Run album, you've picked Mamounia.
Yeah, so I almost didn't pick this one because Pete Perfidis spoke so eloquently and beautifully about it on a previous edition of your podcast that I thought, I actually don't have anything else to say, because he really said it so well. And, but I think I have to pick it because it's always been one of my absolute favourites ever since I used to listen to Band on the Run. I had a tape cassette of Band on the Run, and I loved it. I still love it. I think it's, you know, it's absolutely one of his greatest albums. And I think the moment when he really recovered his confidence, I think that the critical reception, much as he was defiant about it in those early years post Beatles, really knocked him. And I think he wasn't really himself for 2 or 3 years. And whatever happened, this sort of weird magical chemistry that happened during the making of Band on the Run, which, you know, was pretty chaotic. And then its artistic and its commercial success really kind of put him back on track. And this song is just, as Pete said, it's not that well known, but it's absolutely kind of at the heart of his work and his kind of vision of the world. You know, he's always been somebody who he writes about the ordinary things in life and how wonderful they are. This is a big part of his. So, you know, he'll write about his. So Lennon, you know, Lennon's kind of great source of creative inspiration was himself in a way. You know, the great questions of love and loathing and fear and sexuality and all sorts of things. Whereas McCartney was more likely to kind of say, well, I love my sheepdog. I can write a song about my dog.
Yeah.
I'm right, you know, fixing a hole. Maybe I can write about that. You know, just looking around you and saying, but isn't there something wonderful or interesting or fascinating or mysterious about this? So the writer, John Updike, the American novelist, writes sort of very beautifully about domestic suburban life. And I think he said about himself, about his own writing, he said, my task is to give the mundane its beautiful due. you know, what it, to give what it's due to, yeah, to the beautiful mundane. And that is a really kind of pretty good description of what McCartney does. And there's actually another thing that Updike said that kind of stuck with me and makes me think about McCartney's work is, we skate upon a radiance we do not see because we see it, because it's everywhere. So I haven't got that quite, but it's something, yes, something like that. And there is something, yes, about that, you know, kind of McCartney's view, I think, of life is, his intuitive view, and perhaps, you know, his philosophical one too, I don't know, is, we're in heaven, this is it. And just underneath what you take for granted, the ordinary, the boring, the mundane, is something incredibly, is something extraordinary and beautiful, and nourishing and mysterious, etc. So here he just writes about rain. I don't know why he chose Mamunia. I just still don't know what Mamunia means. Perhaps you can tell me in a minute, but he's, yeah, kind of, maybe he just liked the musical sound of it. But when you're listening to the song, you gradually work out that he's singing about rain, and he's saying, don't moan about the rain. You know, it's, yeah, going to rain. Into it, for every little, into every life, a little rain must fall.
Yeah.
And actually, but rain is part of life. You know, just the sadness and depression are part of life, and that they may not be nice to experience at the time, but they are, you know, they're part of being here, and being here is wonderful. And this song just gets me every time. It really is. I just find it a very moving song, and particularly the middle eight, you never felt the rain, my friend, till you felt it running down your back. Something about the way that the voices, the harmonies kick in, and the harmonies kind of build and build throughout the song. The other thing about Wings is that he basically kind of creates a whole new harmonic blend with Linda. This is why Linda is so important to the band, right? She's not just there.
You know.
And it wasn't given that their voices and the voices of them as a group would blend in this way. And this, you know, obviously John and Paul and George's voices blended beautifully. It wasn't a given there either, but again, it's just one of those kind of like mysterious coincidences. But he kind of creates a new blend, and here I think you really hear it at its best, and the harmonies kind of build and build until it is like the sun coming out, you know, after a rainstorm, and it's completely joyous. And this to me, the song is just joyous, and then you can also hear the joy of the sun coming out in the Moog solo that comes in towards the end and kind of comes up and zooms up to as if it's like some sort of animated star kind of coming out, rising up and zipping around the sky. And again, you know,
it reminds me of the way it was used in Here Comes the Sun as well.
Yes, absolutely. And you know, they and then he would take a new technology like that, and instead of doing something incredibly kind of like long-winded and clever and experimental with it, which is, you know, the temptation, they would say, but we just use it as a melodic, we can use it as a kind of extension of the human voice, some, you know, a kind of superhuman voice. So yeah, and as Pete said, it's just a kind of a great pick-me-up. When you know, when things are going badly, he's kind of saying, yeah, but this is life, and we're all lucky to be here, so let's try and remember that. It's a wonderful song.
Yeah, Mamunia means safe haven.
Ah,
from Lagos, by the way. And I think, yeah, musically, just when you think Paul's squeezed every last drop out of melody, then he keeps introducing more and more sections, as you say. I think it's an astonishing piece of music, and so positive, obviously. It's Paul.
Yeah.
Next, we have a Wings single from the 23rd of July 1976, Let 'Em In.
In a way, this is kind of a nothingy song. It's just sort of not much to it, but I love it. And he kind of has an ability to take something. So some of his songs are obviously melodically and harmonically sophisticated. But some of them, he'll just take a little kind of scrap of melody and he'll build an arrangement around it that draws you in. And I think this is one of those. And I think it kind of symbolizes for me a big defining characteristic of him, which is his, as I've been talking about, you know, his openness to everything and to everyone. That kind of egalitarian spirit, you know, whether it's John or Martin Luther, let him in. And it's a gentle way of saying all of humanity is welcome. All of music is welcome. The more difference, the more variety, the better. Yeah. And I think of it as a march. I mean, it is a march, right? He recorded this when he was in New Orleans, right? Or shortly afterwards. And that's what it is, right? So it's a New Orleans march, right? And he kind of has that orchestration as well. So you get the drums, and then you get the flutes, and then you get the trombones. And I picture it, I know it's kind of actually the mise-en-scene of the song is it, in theory it's a house, right? Because he's got a doorbell at the beginning and he's saying kind of let him in, come into the party, join the party. But I also picture it as a march with them kind of marching through, you know, a Mardi Gras or something and saying, come on, join us, you, come on, join us. And this kind of swelling kind of procession of people of all types, of all colours, of all shapes and sizes.
As you're talking, I'm just thinking of from Tommy. There's come to this house, be one of the beautiful people. But that's kind of sickly. And this is done just above the corn belt. And lyrically, it could be deemed slight. But I think they're beautiful. I think they're beautiful lyrics.
It is slight, but it's sort of like just great at the same time. And I like the New Orleans connection because that's kind of where one of the places it all started. Where jazz and therefore blues and rock and roll kind of begins, one of the sources, and he kind of turns it into this ever expanding, swelling procession. Let him in, yeah. And you know, is it Billy Paul that covered it? And
yes,
he turned it into
slightly.
Changed the lyrics in a brilliant way, and I'm sure
you
know Paul would have loved it. And it becomes explicitly about the civil rights movement, and you know he talks about Louis Armstrong, he talks about some of the heroes of the civil rights movement. He kind of drew out what I think was implicit in the song, which is this kind of love of difference and equality, and that everybody has a place here in this music and in this city and in this world. So it's a great cover. It's worth checking out.
I can wait another day till I call you. You've only got my heart on a string and everything a flutter. But another lonely night might take forever. We've only got each other to all the same to me, love, 'cause I know what I feel to be right.
Next single from the 24th of September 1984 and featured in the movie Give My Regards to Broad Street, you've picked No More Lonely Nights.
Yeah, so this is about one of the low points, if not the low point of his solo career in terms of how well he was doing and how he was feeling about. This is Give My Regards to Broad Street, terrible film, that completely bombed. And he was kind of just not doing well musically, commercially, artistically. And yet, even in his bad albums or his less good albums, and even in his kind of low periods, there's usually one or two gems. And I think this is an absolute gem. I think it's a...
Oh.
really, just a really great song. In some ways, it's like, I think as one of your guests said previously, it's a kind of 80s power ballad. But it's a very McCartney-esque take on it, particularly that opening octave leap.
Yeah.
Which I won't attempt here, but that's the kind of such a kind of trademark.
Start low, I find.
Yeah, start low. and again, something that's harder to do than perhaps it sounds, than he makes it sound. And it's just a, I don't know. I won't say much about this. I just think it's a great song. I love that line. If it takes a couple of years to turn your tears to laughter. And that's so much about what he, I think particularly after that depression, after he went through a hard time himself, he's kind of talks a lot about trying to help you turn your tears to laughter. Kind of, making things better. There's a good cover of it by Alison Krauss. I'm surprised it's not covered more because it is such a strong song, but she does a good version of it. She doesn't attempt that octave leap very wisely, although she does something brilliant with it. Like she makes it her own, but that's worth checking out.
I think interestingly, I mean, you say about his from here onwards, I'd say Give My Regards to Broad Street was one of the reasons for it. You know, everything went downhill for a while. But you forget this was a huge hit in the UK. It was number two. But I think notably, it was released before the Give My Regards to Broad Street album and movie. And I remember at the time hearing it thinking, oh, wow, I've got to see this film. This is one of the songs from it. And the expectations were so high. So he's kind of hoist by his own petard. And then obviously people went. There's also a fascinating interview with Paul and Peter Sissons, who obviously knew each other from school, about the film. And Peter Sissons, you can see they're mates, but he's got to say, you know, how are you feeling about this, you know, the bad reviews. And Paul's defending it. He's so charming. And he's kind of saying, well, you know, it is what it is. And he's just got this warm smile. He ends the interview with, all right, mate. Cheers, mate. Thanks. This warm smile. They keep the cameras rolling. And then you see him look over, I guess, to Linda. And he winks. And then Peter Sissons is still, you know, saying, and now the weather. But the camera's still on Paul. And he looks furious. He looks really furious. I can't lip read, but I think I've kind of worked out what he might be saying. But it's that public persona. He's so charming. And he was genuinely hurt. He was genuinely hurt by that. And he took all the critics on board. And the next album, you know, he wasn't that confident about it at all. And he lost that confidence for a long time, I think, till probably the 90s, really.
Yeah.
It was written that I would love you from the moment I opened my eyes, and the morning when I first saw you gave me life under calico skies. I will hold you for as long as you like. I'll hold you for the rest of my life.
Next from the 1997 album Flaming Pie, Calico Skies.
So, I mean, this is absolutely one of my favourite McCartney songs. It's so, again, it doesn't seem complicated, but it's very direct. It's got a beautiful melody. I don't know what to say about it, because I just think this is one of those songs where I just go, you just got to just listen to it. Isn't it wonderful? I can just about play that riff or whatever you call it on the guitar. I'm not a very good guitarist. What I can't get anywhere close to is playing that riff and singing at the same time. So it's actually rhythmically, it's very kind of strange and complicated. But you don't notice that as the listener. Yeah. You're just kind of swept along by it. And that's a very kind of like McCartney-esque trait. Yeah. And, you know, it's a beautifully direct love song to Linda. Now, he writes it before she gets ill. But I think part of the reason it's so moving is that he sings it. You'll probably know more about the history of it, but, you know, there's footage of him singing it with her where...
Oh, yeah.
And she's got very short hair, so I presume this is kind of post-chemo.
Yeah.
And he doesn't look at her. He's right next to her. I mean, I don't know, perhaps he wouldn't have looked at her anyway, but I don't know. I get the sense that he's just thinking, I'm going to play this. If I look at her, I'm just going to fall apart.
Yeah, exactly. It's a most moving piece of footage, though.
It's a great kind of rebuke to this idea that, you know, he left the Beatles and then he didn't really do anything after that. We could name many more examples, but I just think this song is up there with Blackbird as a kind of absolute masterpiece of simplicity on the other side of complexity. So actually, you know, it takes a lot of sophistication to be able to write and play and sing a song like that, but then you hear it,
yeah,
it doesn't sound complicated, it just sort of just hits you in the heart
completely. Yeah, he did like noodling away in D with his bark sort of Blackbird kind of thing. But the thing I find most moving about it, that although it was actually recorded in 1992 during the sessions for the Off the Ground album, so that's 3 years before Linda's diagnosis, I think if he'd written it after the diagnosis, the line "I'll love you for the rest of my life" would be absolutely drenched in sadness. But I think because he had no idea of the future when he wrote them, I find they're really full of hope.
Well, it's both then, isn't it? I mean, we listen to it now and it's both,
yeah,
happy and sad at the same time, like the best music. The way that songs kind of, you know, once they're out there, they just sort of pick up resonances and meanings as they go. They're like stones that picking up moss, and what you know about what happened, it is, to me, kind of infuses the song, an already beautiful song, with just this kind of another layer of sadness and beauty. But yeah, it's just a very powerful song.
Next we have, from Paul's 1998 album with Youth, under the name The Fireman, Palo Verde.
Yeah, so he records, three albums with a producer called Youth. So this is in the mid to late 1990s, right? Is that right?
98.
This one in particular is 98. I hadn't listened to these, and I hadn't listened to this album in particular at all, until I heard your podcast with John Higgs, where he really does a beautiful job of bringing this album to life and talking about it, yeah, as maybe the moment when McCartney's soul is laid bare more than any other album. But in that typical McCartney way of being completely, like, not bare, you know, covered, yes, by layers of oblique, yeah, kind of references. But this album was made as Linda was, as they knew that Linda was dying. And his love for her and his sadness and his joy in the relationship as well is kind of in this, is all over this album. It doesn't have songs on it, like in the conventional sense. It's kind of collage. But once you kind of know a bit about the context of it and you start listening to it, you can hear so much in it. And this track in particular, the sounds of horses, they love to horse ride together, so there's kind of sounds of horse ride,
yeah,
there's her voice is on it, and he's and there's this kind of towards the end, because the music advances very deliberately, so what sounds like a kind of wash of sound at the beginning, you listen to it again and again, you start to hear how carefully it is constructed and what a kind of story it tells. Towards the end, his voice, he starts singing, "Let me love you always." And I don't know, you know, we'll probably never know where that phrase came from. Maybe it came out of a conversation that they were having with each other. I can imagine him kind of saying it to her. But it's very moving, and it kind of moves the way he records his voice and the way his voice is treated. Means it's almost like it's on the verge of fading out all the time. It's just sort of distorted. It kind of comes through these kind of muffled layers. Almost as if the person hearing it is moving in and out of consciousness. And he's kind of calling out and trying to reach someone that, you know, he knows is slipping away.
Oh, you just moved me there. Well, phew. Excuse me. Right.
Stiff upper lip. I mean,
I know. But this is
it's you know, it's well, it's not bizarre. It's just like the story of him and Linda is. It's not like a kind of Mark and Cleopatra. It's not like Richard Burton or Elizabeth Taylor. You know, it's not this huge, tempestuous, dramatic. It's a story of, it's a more kind of domestic, simpler love story than that, mm-hmm. without a lot of conflict or drama. But again, what we've been saying is, you know, it's a master of showing you that what you think is not interesting is actually very deep and profound. And I find their story very, very moving. And I know that lots of people do. And yeah, you can hear it. You can hear it in this album and particularly on this track. The other thing about this, the other thing I wanted to talk about here is just the fact that he has this kind of electronic, innovative from McCartney 3, to McCartney 2 and some of it on McCartney 3 as well. And this kind of trio of albums, you know, it's kind of radical avant-garde part of him, which is sort of under celebrated again, kind of off to the side of our vision of McCartney, but very important to him. McCartney too, in particular, has been influential on a whole kind of generation of electronica and dance artists. And again, it's another thing we just take for granted. Oh yeah, McCartney did that thing, and apparently that was like, well, it's kind of amazing, isn't it, that you could be a pop star and moving through with your 30s, 40s, 50s, and you're still kind of picking up new tricks and kind of saying, oh, I want to learn this. Again, going back to that thing about learning, it's constantly just learning, getting, his learning curve is always kind of pointed steeply upwards. I'm going to pick up this new studio technology and see what I can do with that. Or I'm going to learn classical music and actually get better. You know, if you look at his oratorio, it's really pretty good. He started off with, you know, not so good, just got better and better. And then somebody else pointed out to me in business as well, you know, Apple was a disaster, but then he recognizes that that was a disaster. He sets up MPL, gets into music publishing and makes a big success of that and actually becomes a very kind of savvy businessman. So, yeah, it's just some sort of ability to kind of like pick up complex things and make them part of his armory is extraordinary.
Yeah, and his stamina as well. If you look at the MPL yearly balance, it ain't great. I think it's 76, 77 before it actually starts getting profit.
Ah, interesting, right, yeah.
But he's stuck with it.
Yeah.
The kiss of Venus has got me on the pole. She scored a bullseye in the early morning glow. Then I asked her, have you read the paper? Okay, people talking about which side they're taking. And if you know the baby, what's your take on it? Does it make you wanna leave? I could look the other way for you.
And we end from McCartney 3 Imagined. It's Kiss of Venus. It's the Dominic Fike remake.
So, again, it might be odd to have a song here that's not actually sung by Paul McCartney, but I really like McCartney Imagined, which for anyone who doesn't know is brings out McCartney 3 towards the end of last year. So he has a very productive rockdown, as he calls it. And you think, wow, that's impressive that he managed to get that done. Okay, he didn't record this album himself, but the fact that he's kind of, he and his record company kind of keep going and say, right, let's do an album of covers of this album by young, or just different artists. Some of them are young, some of them not so young. And I think it's really good. I find it like just full of love for inventiveness. Some of the covers are really extraordinary. I picked this one because I think it really exemplifies so much about the album, but also about our relationship to him. So Dominic Fike, I didn't know about him, but he's a kind of young American, singer-songwriter, pop star. Mm. And he really attacks this song and makes it his own in an incredible kind of spirit of freedom, right?
Yeah.
He kind of takes some of it, he adds his own words, he adds his own verses, he adds his own kind of melodic and harmonic. He turns it into a different song, effectively, but still absolutely kind of recognizable from the original. Mm. And it's got a different mood. It's just great. It's sort of joyful. It's almost like, you know, McCartney, he doesn't have a songwriting partner, but if you want to be his partner, you can, you know, literally or metaphorically. Yeah. Just go pitch in, go for it. And of course, you know, he loves it. He didn't say to these people, you know, you got to stick to the words or the lyrics, or he's just like, here's a song, go off and do whatever you want and be free. And again, you know, he wants you to be free in your mind and in your approach to life and in approach to art and to his songs. And Dominic Fike, you know, amongst all of them, I think he just really gets that. And he just kind of throws himself into it. And I love that. Well, there's a couple of things I want to say as we're kind of closing out. But about this kind of remake and McCartney 3 and so on. One of them is that he's really reinventing how to be old. I mean, so,
yes,
you know, he doesn't sort of seem to care about it. He probably does, but the one thing that's interesting about him is that he never apologizes for being the age he is.
Mm.
Most of us, once we get past the age of 30, we start making jokes, self-deprecating jokes about how old we are, how, you know, out of touch we are, what a wreck we are, etc., etc. I just think it's interesting. I don't know if you have. I've just never seen him do that.
No.
No. He just doesn't bother with it. He doesn't bother
explaining
himself.
You never hear the word lumbago in a lyric, do you?
No. But, you know, although, like, in his interviews, he doesn't say, oh, you know, I'm an old man, I'm a bit out of touch.
On my knees.
He didn't say, oh, of course, you know, I shouldn't be singing this kind of song because I'm a different generation. He doesn't do any of that. There's no sort of self-deprecation about his age. He's just like, yeah, I'm doing what I'm doing. And if I want to record a song called Fur You, you know, with a young pop producer, I'm going to do it. He's got no desire to be dignified, which I love. You know, he doesn't care about the dignity of age. He's not kind of playing on his status or his stature at any point. And sometimes he does things which we would say are kind of regrettable. And maybe you shouldn't be singing a kind of sexy song at your age, Paul. And I just think he does not care. And yet it doesn't come across as, I don't think, maybe other people disagree, but I don't think people do think this. I don't think he comes across as sleazy or, you know, one of those kind of like playboys who never wants to get old. He does seem completely kind of at once relaxed about himself and who he is.
Mm.
And at the same time, kind of like, yeah, whatever. I'm still into kind of things that I was into at 25. But he never says any of this. He just does it. And, you know, maybe that's why he's still got, you know, 10 times more creative energy than most of us have ever had. So I think is interesting. And the other thing that I just find moving and lovely is that some of these artists on McCartney Imagined are young, like Dominic Fike, and very, like, innovative and kind of cutting edge. And I just love the fact that they're still inspired by Paul McCartney, by the Beatles. And they still want to take part and be part of that story. It's not nothing to them. I was reading an interview with Dev Hines, who I didn't know about until reading this album, but, you know, he's incredibly in demand, young British producer and artist who lives in New York. About the kind of like most cutting edge hip you can get, really. And he says in this interview, oh yeah, I'm a huge Beatles fan. That's not a given, right? I kind of keep assuming that people are just going to completely lose touch with the Beatles and they won't care about it or reject it because it's part of the past. But here's this guy.
Yes.
Grew up in Essex, I guess, in the kind of like 90s or early 2000s. In some ways, he's kind of marginal, or you know, he's not like in the kind of centre of, in inverted commas, British culture. So he might be someone who you think, well, you know, he's not going to get the Beatles. But of course, the Beatles are not exclusive like that. They are the opposite. They have always been. And this, McCartney plays a huge role here. Inclusive in the most brilliant, poetic, beautiful, profound sense. And everybody can be a part of this great river of music that we have created. Everybody can be a part of this procession. And the more that you are different, the more variety and more diversity, you know, the better. And the more freedom you feel, the more freedom you have to express yourself, and the more we can inspire you, the better. People will be taking that flame on, I think, for generations. And if there's anybody that's going to be remembered, as I said at the beginning, it's him. And I think that just the spirit of difference, celebration of difference, and love for people and for music and for life, I think is what he embodies.
But you think throughout even the early Beatles, the thing was the song is the most important thing. That's why none of the other Beatles appeared on Yesterday when they were splitting up, when they were having the arguments during the Twickenham sessions in 69. Once the music started, they were fine.
Right.
And it was always the song's the most important. I know Paul's been getting a lot of criticism about his voice recently, and he will have known that. So I get the feeling with the remake that he's saying, right, okay, well, the song's the most important. Here you go. You go and play with them. Have fun. And it's a very generous thing to do, just to say, okay, an album I've just had a couple of months ago, going to redo the whole thing with other people.
It is, and it's a kind of... also the kind of implicit acknowledgement that change is not something you should ever resist. So it's take this song and make it better, you know, or certainly make it different, make it your own, you know, play with it, do what you want with it. My song is yours. It's a starting point for you. And, you know, you don't have to be an artist or a musician or somebody who's been invited to record a McCartney track to partake in that spirit. You can take McCartney songs and they will kind of make your life better. They will enhance your life, and you can go back to them and they will mean different things at different times. Like, and I think that's kind of part of his love for songs, is they are both this kind of beautiful finished artifact that you've worked on like a craftsman and you've finished. And they're this thing which is always in motion, always changing, always finding new contexts, always kind of sparking new emotions. And bringing kind of all sorts of different colours and light and shade to our lives. And, you know, there's just nobody alive on the planet who is such a rich emotional generator of such rich emotions as he is. Millions of people have been touched or moved and comforted and amused and or kind of been able to wallow in sadness, been able to kind of find some sort of glimpse of light in the darkness, or have just been thrilled by something that he has created. I just think that's an extraordinary historic achievement.
Ian Leslie, thank you so much for the time.
Thank you, Chris.
And all the best.
Really enjoyed it.